From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Rachel Keith. Thanks for joining us. Lauren Collins recently published They Stole a City, Wilmington's White Supremacist Coup and the Families Who Live with Its Legacy. Collins grew up in Wilmington and recently returned to her hometown to attend a July 17th book discussion event at the Brooklyn Arts District hosted by Floodplain Books. She also stopped by the WHQR Public Media Studios to have an in-depth conversation about the Black and white families who are a part of the Wilmington coup and massacre story, and how its legacy impacted events like the integration of public schools, the Wilmington 10, and the current political battles over how to teach history that involves talking about white supremacy. Many in our area tuned in for Collins' recent visit to CBS This Morning, which focused broadly on how our nation is still waking up to the story of 1898. But for our Cape Fear region community, we're going deeper into what happened. But for those who haven't heard the basics, white supremacist leaders forced the multiracial city government to give up their seats at gunpoint, and they burned down the Daily Record, Wilmington's Black-owned newspaper. They removed Black public servants from their positions on the fire brigade, police force, and customs office, and they murdered countless Black Wilmingtonians, Collins says, dozens, possibly hundreds. But we'll start with why Collins wanted to write this book and a brief history of the places that influenced her upbringing, like attending New Hanover High School and going to church at First Presbyterian in downtown Wilmington. Lauren Collins, thank you so much for joining us on The Newsroom today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Rachel.
I wanted to start with probably a general question that you might get asked a lot about why write this book now. It looked like it took you about 10 years to do this research and publish.
It did indeed. I mean, I grew up here in Wilmington, I should say. And in 2016, I saw Chris Everett's documentary, Wilmington on Fire, which blew me away. And I thought, everybody needs to know this story. I mean, people in Wilmington, but North Carolinians, Americans. And I'm a writer at The New Yorker. I decided to write a short piece about it just to spread the word. I was visiting family here. Chris and I met up so I could interview him. And as part of that, we went down to the 1898 memorial. And we're looking at the official plaque, which kind of, you know, tells the story. It's accurate, but ties it up in a neat bow. It's a very tidy history. And then I looked, and there was another sign that somebody had installed, climbed up a telephone pole. It was nailed to the telephone pole, a piece of plywood, and it says in black kind of stenciled letters, black and red, 1898 war crime. And the juxtaposition of these two signs, this official plaque and this kind of homemade guerrilla effort, said to me that this is a live wire. This is not over. This history is still alive. It still has deep meaning and high stakes for people who are living today. So I saw that and I wanted to go further.
And I wanted to ask, too, when you're introducing that the film really was the spark for you, you write shortly after, yes, you grew up in Wilmington, and that you were even an Azalea Bell yourself. And could you explain to our audience who don't know about what the Azalea Bells are and,
yes,
and what that experience was like?
Yes. The Azalea Bells were, I guess, kind of like attendants for the garden tour and dressed in antebellum hoop skirts. And this was considered, when I was growing up in Wilmington, a great honor for white, I think it was high school sophomores. By the time I came along, there were also some black Azalea Bells. But the point was that it was glorifying this kind of antebellum Wilmington. And so I write in the introduction because I wanted to be very clear about who I am, where I was coming from, what my orientation was to this story. That, yeah, I was an Azalea Bell when I was at New Hanover High School. And it wasn't until several years later when I got to college that I started to understand and explore the connections between white femininity and white supremacy. So I spend a lot of time on white women in this book, the work of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, for example. And I think it's like an underreported part of the story, and it's one that means a lot to me and I think is important. So that was something that I wanted to get into.
Yeah, and I mean, they did, the Cape Fear Garden Club did retire the bells, essentially, in 2020. But just recently, you know, we're starting to see petitions for them to come back. And then it reignites that whole discussion. Because some people say, what's the big deal? They're just wearing skirts and looking cute in the garden.
Yeah. I disagree with that. I mean, you didn't ask for an opinion, but I guess I'm giving you one. I think what I demonstrate in this book is that white supremacy is not a blip or a regression in our nation's history. It's a through line of our nation's history. And, you know, there was a quote that really stood out to me. I mentioned the United Daughters of the Confederacy. When they were erecting a lot of monuments, kind of in the 1910s and the 1920s, they were responsible for the George Davis Monument here in Wilmington. But a kind of mantra for them was, a land without monuments is a land without memories. And so in the book, I examine the United Daughters of the Confederacy and some of the Wilmington women who were quite prominent in it as these really powerful agents of memory and dismemory, and the ways that they used, yes, these public commemorations, monuments, to warp and distort the truth about what really happened in 1898, and also to keep alive this lost cause nostalgia and mentality that the white people of Wilmington and of America were both, you know, the gravest victims and the noblest heroes of this history.
And two, going with your background, you know, you were baptized at First Presbyterian Church, and this was a through line throughout the book as well, because leaders of the 1898 coup did attend that church, and it was featured on CBS This Morning. You were walking through it, and, you know, they were saying, in full disclosure, I've been attending some of the services over the past couple years, and I think it is trying to reckon with its past. And I was at the service when they did read what happened during the coup, and it didn't sound like it was whitewashed or anything. But yeah, I mean, how do you view that church? And I was taken aback that Walker Taylor, Peyton Hoag, was one of the pastors. The Bellamys were prominent members of that church as well.
The book is called They Stole a City. You know, I know many of your listeners know that on November 10th, 1898, white men massacred dozens, possibly hundreds of black men in the streets and then marched to City Hall and overthrew the democratically elected multiracial government in Wilmington. That was Thursday. And on Sunday, Peyton Hoag got up in the pulpit at First Pres and he said, "We have taken a city." And so, yeah, that I learned all this later. I didn't know this growing up there. And so it felt very real and very personal, learning that this place that I had as a child experienced as a place of community and uplift and moral instruction really had this incredibly dark history, yes, was something that hit very close to home.
And that's hard for Americans once you pull the layers back of history, that it is more complicated. Something that you love might have that in the past. And how do you grapple with it now? And how do you think the church is grappling with it now?
Well, to learn that there was this ugly, unacknowledged history, you know, as I said, it really shook me and it compromised and made me question a lot of things about my upbringing, about relationships, about people, about places that were dear to me. I mean, it wasn't just the church. It was Faneuil Hall, where I had my childhood ballet recitals. That was Faneuil Hall, City Hall. But that was the same place where Alfred Moore Waddell threatened to choke the Cape Fear with carcasses. So that's a lot. You know, I've seen how damaging it can be to suppress this history. And I've also seen how good it can be to confront it. The story of 1898 is not over. That is one of the main arguments of the book. And it's what I'm trying to demonstrate is this is living history. It lives among us. And over the 10 years I spent reporting the book, I also understood that there's a renewal happening here of people, of ideas. as you mentioned, First Presbyterian has a new pastor, and while not everybody's on board, I'm sure they've been making an effort to recognize the role that the church played. They mark the anniversary every year. And I find that encouraging and even hopeful that people are trying to make sense of this and come to terms with it.
Yeah, because even Thalian Hall, I mean, Frederick Douglass also spoke there. And
right.
then for First Presbyterian, I read in the book, and we'll talk about this, the Howe family, it sounds like John Harris Howe worked on that church. So you have the two groups coming together in these iconic places in Wilmington. And then I wanted to move to Abraham Galloway. That was really interesting. He was a North Carolina senator. Right after the Civil War, he was elected to that office. Mm. He was a former slave. He escaped to fight with the Union Army. We know from David Soselsky, he wrote the book on Abraham Galloway.
That book is phenomenal. I'm glad you mentioned it.
We just learned so much about how big of a hero he was, and it seemed reflected in your book that, is it correct that he basically kept the Klan out of Wilmington and basically put the kibosh on them at that time? And then that's how Wilmington could become this prosperous place to a degree for Black Americans, for Black Wilmingtonians, because people like him were here.
Abraham Galloway was a legend. And yeah, I wanted to demonstrate that Wilmington, as North Carolina's biggest city at the time, as a port, it was a place where not only goods came in and out, but ideas. And ideas about freedom, about equality, about revolution. Wilmington had a rich history as a place of Black resistance. And one of the most interesting things, I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but I put it in the book because I thought it was so intriguing and so rich, is that Abraham Galloway sailed for Haiti in 1861. And some of his biographers have speculated that he was planning to launch an assault on the slaveholding South from Haiti. I found documents showing that Alfred Howe, the patriarch of the Howe family, a family of distinguished Black builders in Wilmington, also set sail for Haiti in 1861 at the same time as Abraham Galloway. I could not determine.
That was inconclusive, potentially, yeah.
What they were doing there. But they sailed home on the same day in April 61 on separate ships. That's a mystery that remains, and I hope that someone who takes up this work next will be able to make sense of it all.
When you read the book through its entirety and you think about Abraham Galloway and what he did for this community, and why do you think there was not, I mean, Alex Manley could be that figure, but I mean, they were not allowing, right before the coup in 1898, for Black men to own guns, correct? And that the Black regiment was out of town with the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, and I just want to say, Kent Chatfield has done some really interesting work on that. He made a documentary called, I believe it's called, McKinley's Guns.
And so it's hard for us as a modern reader to see the differences. We know that Black people here were massacred and ran off, and they just couldn't come up with a front to even answer the white supremacists.
Well, I think the piece that is really important to remember here. So first of all, this was not only national, but international news when it happened. There was a front page story on the New York Times. It was covered in The Guardian, in all the British papers. And people, both in the lead up, I mean, so many people knew that bloodshed was about to happen in Wilmington. They appealed to the president. They appealed to Republican senators. But those who could have stopped it wouldn't, and those who would have couldn't. So that is part of the tragedy of this. But after it happened, people who were suffering in Wilmington appealed to McKinley, who was the president of the time. So what I'm trying to establish is this wasn't as though a few frantic postcards from the provinces just landed on his desk and nobody ever saw it. One of the women wrote, she wrote as an anonymous woman of Wilmington, and she said, "I am an American citizen. Are we to die like rats in a trap?" McKinley declined to send federal troops. basically he sacrificed the promise of equal protection on the altar of white unity. This was just 30 years after the Civil War. So I think it's just very, very important to point out that the federal government did not intervene, and this sent a message of impunity to white vigilantes nationwide and basically said, anyone who would challenge them, you're on your own from now on.
And reading your book and even David Sacchino's Wilmington's Lie book, I mean, they orchestrated this the year before it happened, like you said.
Absolutely. I mean, the entire year of 1898 was given over. The Democratic Party was running a campaign to lure white voters back to the party from the fusion movement. And they were running on an explicit campaign of what they called the, I quote, all-important and paramount question of white supremacy.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break. Thank you so much. I'm talking with Lauren Collins of The New Yorker, and she has her recent book is They Stole a City, Wilmington's White Supremacist Coup and the Families Who Live with Its Legacy. All right, welcome back to the newsroom. I am with Lauren Collins, who just wrote a recent book. It's called They Stole a City, about the 1898 Wilmington coup. Lauren Collins, I wanted to talk about the reaction after the coup happened. The story, the narrative for a long time was, we put down a black uprising, that there were riots on behalf of the black Wilmingtonians here, and we did our job and shut that down and took back control. And I found a very interesting something you wrote, the more violent they are, the more violent they accuse black people of being. And that's kind of the common, every accusation is a confession. And just, I mean, writing about that, this was known as a race riot for a very long time, and that sounds like both sidism, that we don't know who the aggressor was, and they duked it out, and some people died. How did you approach that?
The men who perpetrated this first called it the Wilmington Revolution, as though it was a glorious uprising of oppressed people. I mean, the big lie that they perpetuated was that white people in Wilmington were living under, I quote, Negro domination, unquote. And so at first, yeah, this was pitched as a glorious revolution. Then, as you said, later it became known as a race riot, which is absolutely a misnomer for the reasons that you mentioned. But one thing to remember is just because they were proud doesn't mean they were honest. In New Orleans, for example, after the massacre of 1866, there was an inquest several years after. In Wilmington, there was no formal investigation of this event until 2000. So one of the things that I tried to demonstrate in the book was the kind of stranglehold that the white elite in this city had on history and the telling of it and the understanding of it for a long time. I mean, you asked me about what I knew growing up. I knew the story of Nancy Martin, the girl who was entombed in a cask of rum and whose grave is in Oakdale Cemetery. So there was like this, you know, we learned these quirks of Wilmington history, but not the things of consequence. And, you know, for many years, the Lower Cape Fear Historical Society was presided over by Lewis Toomer Moore, who was the grandson of Colonel Roger Moore, one of the leaders of the coup. So I was really, as you pointed out, interested in getting at the ways that the white elite was able to monopolize this history for many years.
The through lines, I mean, you follow certain families like the Bellamys, like the Moores, but then you also anchor your book in the prominent black families that made a really big difference and made Wilmington what it is, and that is the Howells and the Halseys.
Right. I mean, the Howells were a family of distinguished builders, and I follow them. I wanted to take a look at what it meant to have built something really substantial in Wilmington and then how they had to adapt the resilience that they demonstrated after the coup. The other black family that I follow, the Halseys, has a different story. They were a working class family, and they were not protected the way that the Howells were. And in fact, Sally Halsey, the matriarch of the family, before 1898, had fallen through the 6th Street Bridge and injured herself, and she was suing the city. Now, there's speculation that that may have made her husband, Joshua Halsey, an explicit target on November 10th. But the Halseys had a different trajectory. For some years after the coup, they tried to hang on in Wilmington. People were banished in the direct aftermath of the coup. But the Halseys demonstrate that people were also hounded out in other ways. There was an exodus of Black people from Wilmington after the coup, preceding the Great Migration by about a decade. So the Halseys went north and remade their lives there. So yes, the Hells and the Halseys and the Moores and the Bellamys and the McCrays all illustrate different aspects of the afterlife of the story.
Yes, and Joshua Halsey, we know, was shot in the back during the coup.
Exactly, and had a much belated funeral here in Wilmington in 2021.
And then I was devastated to learn, I didn't know what happened to Alfred Howe, that he was basically murdered by this man, white man named Kelly, and he was not found, and he was not put on trial. And that was devastating, and he was an elderly man at that point.
Yeah, this was in 1892. Alfred Howe was the patriarch of the Howe family, prominent builders. And he, one morning in 1892, was, I believe, on his way to church, and he got on a motor car, and he got into a dispute with the white motorman named Kelly. Because he was asserting his rights, he told Kelly, you know, you were supposed to pick me up here, and Kelly said no. And in any case, Kelly hit him over the head with some kind of implement. And from the newspaper articles that I found and was able to put together, it seems as if everybody in Wilmington knew that Howe was murdered. In the autopsy, he was examined by white doctors. They said that he died of tuberculosis. But I think the record that I was able to put together establishes that that was very likely not the case. And then Kelly, a bit later, attacks a white man in a bar. I mean, violent attack. And then everybody goes out looking for him. So, yes, it is a devastating story. And it also shows how the pressure was ratcheting up in the lead up to 1898 on the successful, thriving Black middle and upper class in Wilmington.
Right. I mean, Black people in Wilmington had a large part to play in power and leading the city, but there was still this obviously blatant racism.
And omnipresent threat of violence for Black people who asserted their rights.
And I wanted to talk about, and this always intrigued me, I had to read this twice, when David Sacchino's book came out in 2020, in his epilogue in Wilmington's Lie, which he won the Pulitzer Prize for, he said, the report, and this is Larrae Umfleet's 1898 coup commission report that was published in 2006, also challenged an enduring Black myth that whites seized the property of hundreds of Black residents who fled after the coup. Based on a detailed study of deeds and tax records by Sue Ann Cody, the commission found no evidence of widespread property seizures. Wilmington's whites sought to rob Blacks of their civil rights, not property. And we did have a graduate assistant that worked with us. Her name is Samantha Hill. She finally, as a member of the Seahawk, that's the Wilmington student paper, you know, got to interview Cody. She said that her and Larrae Umfleet split the deed records, and they found that most Black people at the time were renters. But through your book, and I was taking note of this, I mean, there was T.C. Miller, that was Isham Quick, Armin Scott, W.E. Henderson, the McDonalds. It looks like they did have a stake in ownership here. And some did stay, but some did flee. I mean, how do you view the property ownership issue?
I'm not a statistician, so I defer to the work of the people who have been through the deeds. I think what's important to remember is that there were all kinds of ways that people were forced to give up, whether it's property, whether it was rentals, but this was home. This is a place where people belonged. They had a community. Something that was really important to me was to look at that diaspora of thwarted potential, of unresolved grief, all these people who scattered all over the country, as I said, in far in advance of the Great Migration. I mean, I think it is difficult to prove. And I have certainly been able to document individual cases. I really can't speak to the overall percentages, but certainly in the newspaper accounts I was reading, you know, the Brooklyn Eagle, for example, was reporting that Wilmington residents had lost their homes. And I found a very interesting article in which an agent from the Sprint cotton compress goes up to Brooklyn in the years after 1898 and tries to get the workers to come home. He was sent on an errand to lure the Wilmington diaspora, to lure them home, and he's not very successful. So I think there's a lot of work to be done on that subject. We also know that the rate of Black business ownership declined somewhat. But then again, you have to look at the qualitative part of it. The percentage doesn't show everything, because we also know that the Black businesses that remained often moved out of the center of town. You know, the geographic distribution was different after 1898. So, yeah, it's an interesting subject to look at, which can be a bit inconclusive.
Yeah, and that could be a basis if reparations ever became a thing, where you would have to calculate business or property loss. But those arguments
well,
here—
Well, we know. I mean, we know that there was loss of life. We know that there was loss of property. 1898, I think, is one of, you know, it is one of the most flagrant cases of unrepaired racial injustice in American history. And unless you're arguing that reparations are never appropriate, Wilmington is an obvious place to start. You have state complicity, you have documented victims and survivors, and you have documented heirs. So I'm not sure that, you know, the inconclusiveness of the housing record rules out reparations at all.
And I mean, you also write in the book about not just monetarily losing housing, having to move your life, but there was also this great period of embarrassment. That one anecdote in your book was Henry Brewington. He was, what, a magistrate?
He was a Black Republican magistrate, and he was politically active in the community. He was also known as a great outdoorsman and oyster shucker, and was famed for having found a lot of turtle eggs on the beach. But sorry, I'll let you continue the question. I think Henry Brewington, though, is his story, I think, is very demonstrative.
Yeah, because he was at Wrightsville Beach working for a family, and they were basically mocking him.
He was working for the Bellamys.
The Bellamys, okay, at Wrightsville Beach.
After 1898. So he, like all the other Black officials, was forced out of his job in 1898, and he found work as kind of a watchman at the beach. And then he was John Dillard Bellamy Jr.'s valet. John Dillard Bellamy Jr. is a congressman by this point. And this is really the era where the perpetrators of the coup are consolidating their power and they're enjoying the spoils.
There was a similar story with Armin Scott, that he was, what, a bellman in New York, and someone recognized him.
Absolutely.
He was a prominent Black lawyer here.
But yeah, so with Henry Brewington, he was working as Bellamy's valet. And Bellamy's a congressman. He brings down a Republican congressman from Michigan, actually, who he's going to do a deal with. And he was basically showing Brewington off and saying, you know, to this visitor from Michigan, hey, this guy here who's my valet, well, he used to be a magistrate, weren't you, Henry? And so I included that anecdote as an illustration both of the cruelty and also the ongoing. I wanted to show that this wasn't over after 1898, and also how tough and how resilient you would be to be a Black person in Wilmington and stay on.
And then going back to the Armin Scott case, he eventually got back on his feet and became, is it a judge?
He became a federal judge.
Yes.
In Washington, D.C.
Because someone said, you know what, you know, you need to go back to this. You were highly respected.
Right. But Armin Scott, he was banished from Wilmington in the wake of the massacre and coup, told never to come back on pain of his life. As you said, but just to reiterate, he was a lawyer, a Black lawyer in Wilmington. And he stayed away for a very long time. He came back to Wilmington towards the end of his life. I believe he was honored at Williston. And there's an interesting account. It shows up in a profile of him that ran in Ebony magazine in the 1950s. But Armin Scott wrote a manuscript about his life and about his upbringing in Wilmington, what he endured here, and his later career as a judge in D.C. And the name of the manuscript was Up From Hell. I've never been able to read it. I mean, I think his, I believe it was his grandson, it may have been his great-grandson, the generations get difficult to keep track of here, but Armin Scott III was generous enough to speak with me about his life. But the manuscript, as far as I can tell, has been lost.
Interesting. Okay, well, we're going to have to take a quick break. You're listening to The Newsroom. I'm reporter and host Rachel Keith talking with author Lauren Collins. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I am here with author and a writer for The New Yorker, Lauren Collins. I wanted to start with, your book is differentiated from David Zucchino's Wilmington's Lie, because you in your book have what is Wilmington like post-1898 and all the way up into current times. And so one story that was really important was Dr. Hubert Eaton, and I have interviewed his grandson that was for Seabreeze, and the Freeman family owned Seabreeze for quite a while. And Dr. Hubert Eaton, in your story, he pushed back. He filed a lot of lawsuits to ensure that the school districts, the buildings, were basically equitable with the white schools. And, I mean, it's part of the legacy, is what I'm assuming you're arguing. And all of the pushback that Dr. Eaton experienced when he was trying to get the schools to be equitable and fight for Black students' rights and the Black community's rights in general, because this was still in the period where a lot of that power had been lying dormant.
Dr. Eaton is such an important part of this story because he was really one of the first people to challenge the order and the hierarchy that the white supremacists had imposed on Wilmington after 1898. And I wanted to show how hard that was. I mean, in his memoir, Dr. Eaton acknowledges this and discusses this himself. He said when he moved here, because he married a Wilmingtonian, he married the daughter of another prominent Black doctor. He writes, "I came to town and I didn't understand why this 1898 thing was such a big deal." And so he said, "I'm going to take on this establishment." One of the big things he did, I mean, in addition to the lawsuits, he was really instrumental in getting Black people in New Hanover County back on the electoral rolls. And he ran for school board over and over and over again. He was the first Black person to run for elected office since 1898. And he lost and he lost and he lost, but every single time he got more Black voters registered. But what was interesting, in his memoir he writes, "I was able to challenge the white elite because I was a doctor and I didn't depend on white people for my employment." So yeah, I think he's a really important part of the story. What did he get for his efforts? An escalating campaign of harassment and intimidation. After he filed his school desegregation lawsuit, he was audited by the IRS. He was a huge tennis player, and he had kind of a legendary court in his backyard. He brought Althea Gibson to Wilmington to finish out her schooling there. But, you know, they were like, "Where are your receipts for your cans of tennis balls?" And then after that, he was actually charged with murder.
Medical malpractice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, this is part of the question that I was trying to ask. I had like a little post-it on my desk as I was writing this book. It said, "America's only coup, and then what?" And so Dr. Eaton's story is, you know, I was trying to connect the dots between 1898, between the consolidation of Jim Crow, between the botched desegregation of schools in Wilmington, the closure of Williston, the Wilmington 10, present-day efforts at political disenfranchisement and voter suppression. It's all related.
I wanted to mention, too, I mean, Dr. Eaton, you really feel for him. He feels sometimes alone, like even the community doesn't come and support him. And he feels like he's going up against this large Goliath alone. And I kind of made a little connection to Alex Manley, who was the owner of the Daily Record. And he was a person of color, but he could pass for white. What, you know, lit this on fire, according to the white supremacists, was him basically writing an editorial responding to Rebecca Felton's speech about how that we have to lynch black men because they're going after white women. And he basically responded to them and said, that is not true. And you need to worry about white men going after black women. And is it so unfathomable that a black man, a white woman would have a consensual relationship? But I learned from your book, too, that Alex Manley, I mean, a lot of black, prominent black people were also saying, retract that, retract your editorial so that we can be safe. I feel like people like Dr. Eaton and Alex Manley, they are taking a stand in their value system and what's right. And it can be lonely there.
As I said, Eaton, he understood that black people who had grown up in Wilmington were understandably and rightfully very fearful of reprisal and intimidation from the white community. So there were employers who said, if you register to vote, you will lose your job. Again, Eaton was very explicit about the fact that he was self-employed. He was a black doctor for the black community. So yes, he was courageous. I mean, he, and along with some friends, led the integration of the golf course in Wilmington. And he was like, I don't own a nine iron, but I pay taxes just like everyone else. And this municipal amenity should be available to me. So yes, he was absolutely instrumental in the first challenges to this white power regime that had reigned more or less uncontested since 1898.
And he was eventually acquitted of that medical malpractice. But the interesting fact was his lawyers were a descendant of George Rowntree and then John Birney, who were his lawyers that helped get him out of this.
It's hard to know. I mean, as I write in the book, it's hard to know what to make of that. They certainly were not in agreement about civil rights, about social equality for black people. I think Eaton knew that in order to stand a chance in the judicial system here, he also had a black lawyer on his team whom he had worked with in the school desegregation lawsuits. But yeah, I think he knew that he had a better chance of pushing back against these wrongful accusations if he had some stalwarts of the white elite on his legal team.
And then switching forward, I mean, Dr. Eaton is a big part of your book, and then the Wilmington 10 are a big part of this legacy. And it seemed like those students were also alone without a lot of guidance because they wanted to assert their rights in the community. It was one of the springboards was how history was taught even. But it's such a complicated story. All of them were exonerated. Wayne Moore, one of the Wilmington 10, he was featured in your book. And actually, Wayne Moore comes out to public events now to speak. When Mary Washington Howe, one of the Howe family members, a preschool is named after her, the school district was potentially going to close that school down, but the community came out to say, don't do this. And Wayne Moore was there. And I mean, this was a big part of your book. And sadly, you know, one of the other Wilmington 10, Willie Vereen, just passed away. Some of them have passed away. But it was also an international story, the Wilmington 10.
Absolutely. I mean, this was something that Barbara Walters brought up with Fidel Castro. Actually, you know what? I don't think Barbara Walters brought it up at all. It was Castro who brought it up when Walters was questioning him about human rights in Cuba. And he said, don't talk to me about human rights in Cuba when you've got the Wilmington 10 languishing in jail. Khrushchev invoked the Wilmington 10. I thought this is a really important part of the story because well into the 1970s, you have the white elite and the white supremacists upholding this racial hierarchy that they had established in 1898.
And the prominence of the rights of white people, just that group in the 70s.
Right. And so yeah. The students are some of the first people who push back against this. Now, their greatest asset, which was their willingness to stand up, was also their greatest vulnerability. And they were on their own. I mean, nobody was really looking out for them. You know, just to give the brief story, they started a boycott of the schools. They established what they called a freedom school at Gregory Church. And this boycott very quickly turned into what effectively became a siege, with white supremacists from the Rights of White People Party, for instance, shooting into the church. They returned fire. A number of buildings went up in flames during this. So that was 1971. And in 1972, it was initially 10 students and one white woman who was a social activist were arrested for the arson of Mike's Grocery. As you said, they were granted pardons of innocence in 2013 by Governor Beverly Perdue. But you mentioned Wayne Moore, and he wrote a memoir that is everyone should read. And he wrote about this nonviolent boycott that essentially turned into a small war. He wrote, "Had this been a different time before there were national television radio news, we would have been slaughtered like our predecessors had in the massacre of 1898. Our slaughter would eventually come, but it would be largely bloodless and done in the light of day with a public veneer of the just and lawful."
And two, this continues. I mean, the issues that we see from the Wilmington 10, we also eventually see the legacy of 1898 is not at the forefront. Do you feel like it's fair to say that Philip Gerard, a writer who has since passed, and he was a professor at UNCW, if he had not written Cape Fear Rising, that 1898 would have not gotten the traction in this community without that book?
I can't say for sure, but I think it's clear that the publication of Gerard's novel, which it was a novel, but it named names.
It used
real names. He wrote about Hugh McRae. He wrote about Walker Taylor. This was in the early 90s, and it really got people talking. It caused a tremendous amount of controversy. Philip Gerard faced a lot of pressure, a lot of backlash from members of the white community, of the white elite. Yeah, it was a seminal moment because it brought a lot of this out into the open. And in 1998, it was the centennial, obviously, of 1898, and it was the first public acknowledgement and commemoration of what had happened. Now, something I found really interesting when I was going back through the papers at UNCW, you know, such was the legacy of 1898 that when some people heard that there would be a commemoration, they assumed that because the movers and shakers and these pillars of society were putting something together about 1898, they thought that it might be a celebration rather than a sober commemoration of what had happened. So, yes, it was something that hadn't happened before, and there were a lot of questions swirling around about how Wilmington would finally publicly acknowledge what had happened.
And you write in regards to the trustees that were potentially at UNCW going to deny him tenure, and one trustee, and I wanted to make this point after I read this, I want you to change the names. And in some instances, for those who are listening in our local community, you know who the commissioners are who voted against changing the name of Hugh McRae Park to Longleaf Park. And that was Republican commissioners Pat Cusick and Woody White. You know, at the end with the person, the school board member, Pete Wildebor, was the one who was nervous about how 1898 was being taught. But yeah, I was curious, was it because you wrote for a national audience that you didn't necessarily name more of the recent people?
There's a really easy explanation for that, which is that there are just so many names. I just couldn't ask readers to, and as you said, many of my readers will not be familiar with these names.
Yes. Do you know which trustee said that? I want you to change the names.
I don't. Philip Gerard told me that. He did not give me the name.
Let's go back to the racial healing. It sounded like from your book, it was, let's both celebrate this sobering experience, like a both-sidism type of celebration instead of who were the real perpetrators and who were the victims. It sounded like we're going to come together and heal, but there really wasn't an acknowledgement sometimes of what really happened. For example, you have people just saying, let me just write the check. Are you happy with this now that I've written you the check? Are we done now with this healing time?
Yes, many of the descendants of the white perpetrators did participate in the 1998 commemorations. And some of them sort of thought that it should have been settled once that had been done. I do think the 1998 commemorations were an important first step. Mm-hmm. As I said, it was an imperfect but critical acknowledgement of what happened, because this was the truth coming out in public for the first time. And there were some events that were less successful, and then there were some events that were very successful. For instance, when John Hope Franklin spoke as the keynote speaker at the symposium that UNCW held around that time. So I look at that as, yes, that era.
He's a prominent historian, correct? John Hope Franklin.
Yeah, whose own father witnessed the Tulsa massacre in 1921. But so I look at the 90s period as a really important history where people in Wilmington really started. This 1898 came out of private family conversations and into the public sphere.
And two, part of the legacy, which I thought was interesting, it looks like Hugh McRae's descendants, Hugh the Third and Meg McRae, they are having an honest grappling of their family's history. And it's interesting because in New Hanover County Schools, I follow the school system, there's been a backlash against, you know, sometimes if you teach this history or you teach this history the wrong way, you might make white people feel wrong. Or one school board member, Pat Bradford, at one point said, why are we talking about oppressed people this, oppressed people that? It's like this message of greatness or perfection that we can't damage. And I've talked to a lot of sometimes people in the GOP. I've talked to the former head of the New Hanover County Republican Party. His name's Nevin Carr. Even Phil Berger, when there was an indoctrination in North Carolina schools report, Phil Berger came out with former Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who tried to run for governor. Hey, let's teach the history. But that history is gone. Let's not tie it to the present, because that's not happening anymore. So you need to teach redlining. You need to teach 1898, but it needs to stay in that era. There's no through line to 2026. And that is what I am hearing over and over again. So I wanted to get your take on that.
Thank you for putting that all together. My book is an emphatic rebuttal to that view of history, that we can look at these events in isolation. My entire argument is that the antecedents and the afterlife of 1898 were copious, they're messy, they're complex, and we can't just put 1898 in a little container and isolate it without looking at it in its longitudinal fullness, in the full sweep of history. And so that is why I chose, I mean, as we've been talking about, to include the consolidation of Jim Crow, the era of monument making and of dismemory, Williston, school desegregation, the Wilmington 10, exactly, you know, all of the kinds of things, the event, the current efforts to suppress uncomfortable or inconvenient history. This is all part of one story.
And it's interesting to see where we're going to go in the future. I mean, right now we have directives where you can't say certain words or you can't profess certain ideas. And I don't think any educator would say you have to believe this or you're going to fail. But just even talking about racial issues and talking about these racial issues throughout time and white supremacy and how that plays a part.
But so there is. I mean, Rachel, there's this pattern of an expansion of rights on the other side of any era where you have an expansion of rights or advances in the telling of history, somebody is waiting on the other side to claw them back. You pursue Reconstruction, you get Jim Crow. desegregate, be met with massive resistance, elect a black president, endure a white nationalist one who denies that his predecessor was a citizen. So I'm arguing that the origins of our current crises are right here in our own violent past, and that by learning this history, by grappling with it, and by shouldering the truth of it, I've seen how damaging it can be to suppress this history. But I also think that very good things can happen when we confront it and when we take on the truth.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Lauren Collins. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to author Lauren Collins for joining us. Music for today's show was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. And if you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Keith. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.